My plan for this evening is really just to share a few thoughts out of my book about monopolizing knowledge. You might wonder what the expression monopolizing knowledge is all about. Monopolizing knowledge is in a certain sense a criticism of what I think is one of the most important aspects of trying to understand the relationship between science and Christianity. And it is that in our society as a whole today, scientism, which is the belief that essentially all the real knowledge there is science, it has an enormous hold on our minds and on our society. And I think it's one of the most important factors that confuses and makes difficult the relationship, understanding the relationship between our Christian faith and our science. And my book, by the way, I have some copies of the book if you're interested. So if anyone is inspired to read it, I can let you have a copy, and I'd be happy to sign it. I can let you have a copy at my cost. But the point of my book is to explore this scientism, to explain it, to understand it, to look at its history and the extent to which it's justified, and its influence on society. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to move about a little bit. I'm a little bit hampered by this microphone, but my voice isn't in top shape at the moment, so I'm going to continue to use it. Under normal circumstances, I would have despised this. So when I give these kinds of talks, particularly to secular groups, there's often a question that arises. Well, you know, is there really such a thing as scientism? Is it widespread? And so I usually start by giving some examples of scientism. So here's a few examples. If you read Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, or about half a dozen places in that book, he says things like, the existence of God is a scientific hypothesis like any other. Another book by someone called Paul Cathagard, which is about the brain and the meaning of life, it's about trying to understand the brain, he says, what is reality? Those things and processes identified by well-established fields of science using theories backed by evidence drawn from systematic observations. So this is a good description of science, but as far as Thagard is concerned, science is to be identified with reality. These are fairly explicit espousals of the scientific viewpoint of scientism. The most direct and explicit that I've come across comes from this philosopher, Alex Rosenberg. In his book from a couple of years ago called The Atheist's Guide to Reality, he refers to scientism. He defines it in exactly the way I do, which is it's the conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge of anything. He then says that science provides all the significant truths about reality. And if you hadn't quite got it, he goes on finally to say, once you adopt science, you'll be able to cease treating the humanities as knowledge. Well, that's pretty extreme. But more often than not, scientism in our culture today is not nearly as explicit as any of these. It's much more implicit. But you can see it and you can detect it all around us. It's in the media, it's in the ways people think about things. Here's an example from a couple of years ago from the BBC website. And they discovered a new Indian language that had not been previously documented. And the headline is, Indian language is new to science. Now my question to you is, since when has the knowledge of languages been science? My answer is, it never has been. What is really meant here is new to scholarship. But the word science is being used as a kind of honorific to kind of promote things, because people have this underlying sense that, well, if things are really known and if things are really serious knowledge, well, then they're really science. Now, how can this opinion survive when you begin to think about it? The answer is, in part, because there's a great deal of confusion in the semantics of our discussion and our use of the word science. Scientism is not a problem of semantics, and yet it's very helpful to understand some of the background and the history of the semantics, because then you begin to realize how scientism can continue to thrive. You see, the Latin derivation of the word science, which is from the Latin scientia, is indeed simply the meaning knowledge. And long ago, that was the meaning of the English word science, and indeed the French word science. So, for example, if you think about the 18th century and the French encyclopédie, which was in a certain sense the manifesto of the French Enlightenment, there science is defined just meaning the clear and certain knowledge of something. Even in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, someone like Thomas Macaulay would use the word science simply to mean the growth of the human mind. In both these cases, the paradigms or the examples of science would mostly be natural science, but the word was being defined as meaning just knowledge. And even into the 20th century, a philosopher like R.G. Collingwood could use the word science to mean any body of systematic or orderly thinking. And he did so actually in a book, a fascinating book, which was at pains in many respects to criticize scientism. And yet, he used the word science to mean a body of systematic or orderly thinking. Now, I would assert that if you adopt this meaning of science, then scientism, the belief that science is all the real knowledge there is practically speaking a tautology. It's actually true, okay? Because if science just means knowledge, then, you know, all the knowledge there is knowledge. So that's all you're saying. But of course, today, that isn't what we mean by the word science. What we mean by the word science would once have been called natural philosophy. We mean natural science, the study of nature. And even though the old-fashioned, archaic meaning lingers in expressions like political science, which of course is not a natural science, nevertheless, when we use the unqualified word science, we today mean natural science. So when we're talking about science and religion, for example, we're not talking about reconciling Christianity or the gods and goddesses of ancient Rome, for that matter, with the latest economic theory. No, we're talking about the compatibility of our teachings with a modern understanding of physics, chemistry, biology, botany, zoology, geology, cosmology, and so forth. And this question of the relationship between science and faith is such an important one in our society, precisely because science has enormous epistemological prestige. People really believe what scientists claim, but based on its amazing growth and success. Nevertheless, if science really still meant just any contemplative knowledge, systematic knowledge, then theology would, I assert, still be a science. But these days, I don't think, with our current meaning of science, it makes sense to call theology a science. And it certainly isn't the queen of the sciences. Now, the next thing that might cross your mind as you're thinking about this is that some people would say, well, really, there is nothing special about science. Science is just finding out about nature as best we can. In other words, isn't science really quite straightforward? It's just the study of nature. Well, using that phrase, the study of nature, as a way of trying to understand what science is, doesn't work terribly well. And the reason it doesn't work terribly well is because, if anything, the word nature is more ambiguous than the word science. This has been recognized for hundreds of years. This is Robert Boyle. He was one of the founders of the Royal Society in London, and so, in a certain sense, one of the instigators and early players in the scientific revolution. We've all heard of Boyle's Law, I suspect. And he recognized that this concept of nature is very far from being clear. In fact, he was so exercised about it that he wrote a whole book that is entitled A Free Inquiry into the Vulgarly Received Nature, a notion of nature. They had wonderful titles in those days, didn't they? And in that book, he lists 8 different meanings of the word nature. And his whole purpose in writing this book is to deprecate the Aristotelian meaning of nature, meaning that, you know, heavy objects have a nature of heaviness, and that that was the explanation in Aristotle's physics of why they fell downwards. Boyle was at pains to criticize that meaning and to emphasize that what we really mean by nature is the settled course of things. And I think that is actually a profound and important viewpoint to maintain. But at any rate, the point is that nature is really rather an ill-defined concept. And so when we're trying to think about what science really is, science is best understood through its methods rather than its topic. So its topic, you know, would be nature, but really that isn't the way we understand science. I think we understand science through its methods. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what the methods of science is. I think many of you know what the methods of science are, but I want to draw your attention to these because I think if you understand that science is in effect defined by its methods, then you begin to realize there have to be limitations to what science can encompass and what science can understand and what science can know. So I think the distinctive characteristics of science are things that we understand well. They're things like observation, experiment, measurement, systematization, mathematization, self-consistency, universality, and so on. I think these can be summarized under two rather abstract but nevertheless helpful headings. The first is reproducibility, that science depends upon the reproducibility of the world, in particular in respect of repeatable experiments and observations. And secondly, that science depends upon something that I call clarity. But this means that there must be unambiguous descriptions of measurements. And this often leads us to classification, mathematics, and so forth. I'm going to unpack these two characteristics of science a little bit for you. Michael Faraday was a fascinating character in the history of science in the 19th century. He had almost no formal education. He left school at age 13, and he was apprenticed to Mr. Rebo, the bookbinder. And that's where he got his education, reading Mr. Rebo's books. It was a self-education. He rose by a roundabout route, again, much great deal of interest in Faraday's biography, to be perhaps the preeminent experimental scientist of the middle of the 19th century in England. And Michael Faraday said about himself that he had the most amazingly strong imagination. He said he could imagine the Arabian Nights as soon as anything else. And he said that that imagination had to be constrained by what he called the facts. So he said, the facts were important to me and saved me. He said, without experiment, I am nothing. And that's because he recognized, he felt in his bones, the vital necessity of repeatable experiments in science. And it was said of Michael Faraday that whenever he would hear or read about a new discovery in those heady days of the development of electricity and magnetism, the first thing he would do is he would rush down into his lab in the Royal Institution in London, and he would try to reproduce those results, because he knew how important reproducibility was. And I like to think that this woodcut is a representation of Michael Faraday going down into his lab in the Royal Institution and reproducing those results. And was this because Faraday was an arch-skeptic, or did this attitude make Faraday into an arch-skeptic? Quite the contrary. He was a lifelong Christian. He was a member of the nonconformist Sandemanian Church. And in that church, he was an elder for two substantial periods of his adult life, and being an elder in the Sandemanians meant you were basically the minister. You preached on Sunday, and they had Sunday services that went for 3 hours or more, making us look somewhat ashamed of ourselves, perhaps, that we can't go for longer than maybe an hour and a half at most. And he would visit the sick and so forth, in addition to his scientific career. So reproducibility in experiments is vital. But you might say, well, I'm going to skip this next one. This is, if someone asks me later, I'll tell you about this. Okay, but my research is in hot fusion, not cold fusion. Cold fusion is a very interesting event in the history of science in the late 20th century, but it again illustrates the vital nature and dependence of science upon reproducibility. But how can that be, Ian? I mean, if you think about astronomy, which after all we think is a science, you can't do experiments on the stars, so how can reproducibility be an important part of observational science? But of course it is. The reason why astronomy was in a certain sense the first of sciences, it's the first of the disciplines in which really the idea of science really got applied and developed, is precisely because any number of observers can look up at the stars and see the same thing. You can do so from different places on the globe. You see systematic differences if you look very carefully, but mostly they look the same. The motions of the stars are extremely repeatable and predictable, and so reproducibility really applies. Even for something as singular as a supernova, there are reproducible aspects that remain available for us repeatedly to observe. For example, the Crab Nebula, which was the result of the supernova of 1054 that was observed by Chinese astronomers, and by the way, apparently not observed anywhere in Europe. Maybe it was something to do with the place in the sky that it was. So my point about this is that reproducibility is just as important in the observational sciences, like astronomy, but like others too, as it is in the experimental, the lab sciences. It's just that reproducibility doesn't mean some kind of simplistic reproducibility at will. It means you've got to have multiple examples of something. So, for example, if you think about botany in its early stages, perhaps in its 19th century stages, it wasn't sufficient to have a single specimen of some new species. Ideally, you need multiple species. You need to have a track of where they came from, and you need to be able to, at best, if you had a reproducing community or specimen, so that you could have multiple examples, then you were in business. But many, many things in our world and in our lives simply do not possess the kind of reproducibility that is necessary for the natural sciences. And I think the best example I know of this is history. Only a tiny fraction of the things that history studies can benefit from analysis that bears the stamp of the natural sciences. How do we know, for example, the truth of the statement that Julius Caesar was assassinated on the steps of the Roman Senate on the Ides of March in 44 BC. We don't know it by science or by any of the methods that we consider to be the most crucial ones for science. And yet, we really do know that fact. It is a genuine piece of knowledge. History has real knowledge. It's just not scientific knowledge. There are many such disciplines that have real knowledge, but aren't in any meaningful sense like the natural sciences. I would cite economics. Economics is a good example because economics is highly rigorous, very often very mathematical, and yet because it's dealing with highly irreproducible situations where the actors within it are not passive but active choosers, and because we can't go back, we can't do an experiment and then go back on an economy and then go back and do another experiment on the economy, economics can't really be approached in the same way as the natural sciences. And when it comes to politics, I mentioned the idea of political science earlier. Politics, of course, we're really exchanging what we're looking for in the natural sciences, consistency and predictability, with all kinds of pragmatism and public opinion and so forth. And so politics is, as a science, only in the archaic sense of a science, as being a systematic study, not in the sense of the natural sciences. Now, when I say these disciplines aren't sciences, my colleagues in these disciplines, or disciplines like them, will sometimes bristle, because they think that when I say that these are not sciences, it's a put-down. They think that I'm being critical. But they shouldn't. The reason they think that is because they think, like many other people in our world today, in scientistic terms. They think that if something isn't a science, then it isn't real knowledge. But I don't believe that. I think that's wrong. I don't subscribe to scientism. So when I say something isn't a science, it's not a put-down. It's simply a statement that the methods of this discipline are different from the methods of the natural sciences. It's true, nevertheless, that their disciplines are greatly distorted by scientism. And the very word scientism got its first predominant usage in a book that was written by Friedrich Hayek, who was a Nobel Prize-winning economist in the early 1950s. And the whole purpose of his book was to criticize the social sciences, social studies disciplines, for pretending to be like natural sciences when they aren't. So it's not that a scientist is criticizing, you know, social disciplines. There is criticism even within their own discipline for this inappropriate approach. Let's see. The requirement of clarity. So I'll move on to my second characteristic, clarity. So clarity is, in a certain sense, a foundational requirement for the expression and communication of reproducibility. In other words, you have to be able to express the results of an experiment or an observation in terms that are sufficiently unambiguous that you can tell, you know, if you have a reproducible result or not. If it's too wishy-washy and you don't really know what the result is, then you can't tell. This very often leads us, in the sciences, into measurement. So when we reduce the descriptions of nature into numbers, then that gives supreme clarity, because numbers and mathematics in generally are things which have supreme clarity in the minds of those people who are trained to understand them. And so mathematical expression is indeed an ideal, at least of the physical sciences. But I don't think that mathematics is the whole story with respect to clarity, and that's why I use this word clarity rather than mathematics or something like that. Because clarity is to do with having clear descriptions, unambiguous results. And actually there are many skills, for example, field skills in fields like botany or other disciplines, geology, which are very important for conveying clarity and preserving and establishing clarity. And yet they're not really mathematical. They're much more human and organizational. Or if you think about physiology, for example, physiological descriptions, that's not mathematical, but it is very important that it should be clear and unambiguous. So clarity is a vital part of science. This, by the way, is a photograph of the Danish copy of the International Kilogram. The kilogram, this is supposed to remind me to say something about units. Measurements, of course, aren't just numbers, they're also units. And so units are terribly important in science, having stable units. And this the way that kilograms, the units of mass, are still defined is in terms of an artifact. Actually, they're the last of the physical units, the foundational physical units, that's defined in terms of an artifact. The others are defined in terms of a physical phenomenon. And this, and people are working hard to change that, to find a way establish the units of mass by a phenomenon, but we aren't quite there yet. At least they're not as accurate as the international kilogram. But many, many topics in our world and in our lives don't possess the kinds of clarity that science demands. And here are a few examples of the kinds of things in our lives which don't possess the unambiguous clarity that science insists upon. I won't read them out. But that's not to say there cannot be some scientific description of some parts of these questions. If we were to take, let's say, the beauty of a sunset, of course, science can, physics can say something about why does the sky become orange, you know, as the sun is setting, and it can explain the coloration in terms of scattering from dust particles and the gradation up the sky to do with the different angles of scattering that are involved and so on and so forth. So there can be a perfectly good scientific description of a sunset. But when you've got that scientific description, I think you reach the point of suddenly realizing, well, you've missed the point, which was not the sunset, but the beauty, okay? So there are many things which really can't be described with this unambiguous clarity. Music is one of the ones that I like to point to as an example of an area where we don't have this kind of clarity. Of course, we can record music with very high precision and play it back, but I think many people realize that that doesn't really get to the heart of what music is all about. So at this point, I like to do a little demonstration and ask you the question about this event. I'm just going to play this little clip, okay? The question is, what is this event? What is this event? Now, of course, in a certain sense, you could describe this event, if you focus on this young lady here, you could say that what's going on here is that there are two pieces of mostly copper alloy that are coming into close proximity. The electrons' wave functions are interfering with one another. They're transferring an impulse to the atoms of the crystal lattice. And that is propagating through with the mostly copper alloy, and it's coupling to compressional waves in the air, and those compressional waves are then propagating out into the confined space in which this is taking place. Now that's a scientific description of this event. It's a correct scientific description, okay? Perfectly correct. But it seems to me that that clearly doesn't come to the heart of things. So you could go up a level and you could say, well, all right, again, focusing on this young lady, we could say that she is playing the cymbals. Okay, that's another way of describing this event. It's a true description of this event. If you think about the guy with the hammer, it's a little bit more puzzling, okay, because we don't usually think of the hammer as being a musical instrument. But in this particular case, this is an important part of this this event. But even that level's insufficient, okay? Because you recognize that these two players aren't on their own. They're part of a symphony orchestra. So there's another level above them, the symphony orchestra, that you should describe this event at. And that's not high enough still because, of course, the whole point of a symphony orchestra is the music, okay? So that there's a question of the music, and this music actually is from Mahler's Sixth Symphony. It's the famous hammer blow. Those of you who are classical music buffs know this, but maybe you're not classical in your taste. But at any rate, it's a very famous moment in Mahler's Sixth Symphony. And actually, in reality, there's even further than that, and that is to recognize that music, the meanings of music, are really present only not in the scientific descriptions, but only in the reception, in the hearing of the music, in the listener. And so what music does is evoke in the listener all kinds of things that are partly in the listener and partly in the music. And so it's a complicated maelstrom of ideas in which the meanings of music are coupled with both the hearing, the playing, the events, the history, the background, and so on and so forth. And so the whole point is that a scientific description of this event, particularly one at the reduced level that I gave you first of all, kind of misses the point. And I think everyone can recognize that there is meaning at different levels of description. And having a description at one level doesn't rule out the truth of those descriptions at other levels. meanings at multiple levels can simultaneously be valid.